I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson. In a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick, Galen, Arlen, Bo, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan, David, The West Bank Robbery Podcast, Gary, Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho, Brian, Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Another edition of Parallax Views on the latest unfolding events in Israel, in Gaza. This is a very difficult topic. Abe Silberstein, a Jewish American journalist who has written for multiple publications, joins us to discuss the events that have unfolded in the past week. Let's get right to it with Abe Silberstein.
Welcome back to Parallax Views. Abe Silberstein, who's written for a number of publications, including Haaretz, The Foreword, The Los Angeles Review of Books, a number of different publications. He's here to talk with us about the latest developments with Israel and Palestine. And of course, we're coming off the Hamas attack and the reaction that we're seeing from Israel right now. We're going to talk about all of that. How are you doing, Abe?
I'm doing okay given the circumstances, but I haven't slept much over the last 48 hours.
That's very understandable. What's your general assessment of what has transpired? And what do you think people are missing in the current flurry of analysis, a lot of which I think can be very poor at times because we're deluged with, you know, social media posts about all of this and not all of it is very accurate.
Right. I think the central point that one can take away from this so far is that the notion that Israel had of Hamas and Palestinians more generally over the last couple of years, might even say the last 10 years or 15 years, has been completely shattered. The way over the last, since Netanyahu returned to power in 2009 and in his subsequent government since then, as well as the government, the so-called government of change that was in power for 1 year in 2021, the view of Hamas has been that they're mainly not looking for any sort of escalation with Israel, that they're looking to just keep their fiefdom in Gaza, to have this this power within the Gaza Strip, and not to that their commitment to liberating Palestine or to, you know, being the image of the resistance was no longer a major factor. And this is the reason why, for instance, Israel facilitated cash transfers to Hamas via Qatar for many years, because even today, currently, Israel has no alternative to Hamas in Gaza right now. They are the only viable government in Gaza, and I don't see that changing in the fundamental calculations, despite the fiery rhetoric that we're hearing from Israel, from Netanyahu, from members of his party, and frankly, across Israeli society at the moment.
So in regards to the attacks, which, I mean, to me, this is very just tragic, the amount of lives that have been taken. What are we to make of this in terms of Netanyahu's government? Because I've seen at least some voices in the Israeli media, including the Times of Israel and Haaretz, most notably, saying, you know, this is a massive intelligence failure. For years, Netanyahu has in different ways propped up Hamas. You know, where does the blame lie?
It was a major intelligence failure. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Intelligence and even just operational failure. Yeah.
There's no question. And the fault for that does lie with Netanyahu, who has been in power for most of the last 14, 15 years. So there's no getting around that. And I'm not surprised that the Israeli press and even members of the opposition, who are a little bit more muted, but are still voicing criticism of the government now. I don't see how Netanyahu leaves this unscathed in any way. This is a much greater disaster than the Yom Kippur War that ended up discrediting the Labor Party in the 1970s. Where did I cut out?
I believe you were saying that this is the greatest disaster, or Netanyahu,
the greatest disaster since the Yom Kippur War. And I think it's actually an even bigger political disaster, because at least at that time, one could say that the intelligence and the military operation abilities were still up to par. What's happened here is that there's been a political failure and a military failure and an intelligence failure. We've had all three. And that's, I think, something that will be very difficult for Israelis to overlook when this is all said and done. On the point about Israel propping up Hamas, I could only reiterate that I don't see an alternative beyond, and this is what Brett Stevens suggested in his New York Times column this morning, of a regime change operation in Gaza. But then the question becomes, who actually governs Gaza on the day after? Is it going to be Israel? I highly doubt it. I don't think Israel wants to return to governing the daily lives of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. Will it be the Palestinian Authority? It sounds fantastical that the Palestinian Authority would march into Gaza, set up a government on the backs of a brutal Israeli invasion. It just seems completely unrealistic to me.
In regards to the intelligence and operational failure at work here, could you speak more to that? Because I, like I said, I've seen Israeli publications deal with it, but I'm not seeing it as much in U.S. media. Where did things go wrong? And, you know, what role does the far right coalition have in this? Because it seems like their attention was focused on things other than, you know, the Gazan border, and maybe this could have been prevented.
Yeah. Keeping in mind that we don't yet have all the information available to us, but what seems to have happened right now is that there were certain intelligence capacities on the border that were disabled via both Hamas drones and other sort of attacks. And following this, they penetrated the feds and entered Israel. So what the first major failure that one could identify from looking at this is that there weren't sufficient Israeli ground forces in the area. And what seems to be the case, and Israelis have said this as well, is that there was a big focus on the West Bank, where we've had tensions between settlers and Palestinians. And the far-right government, or members like Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, have been demanding a very harsh response in the West Bank. And many resources were moved there to the detriment of security on the southern border, where, again, it was assumed that Hamas was not interested in conflict.
With regards to, you mentioned Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir. So Netanyahu is, of course, with the Likud party. Ben-Gvir with
Otzma Yehudit, translated Jewish power.
Right, and then Smotrich, I believe, is the religious Zionist party, right?
Yes.
But there's also a few other parties. Who are the most important parts of this coalition government, though?
So Likud is the single largest party in the coalition. That's the party of Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and several other cabinet ministers. The other important piece of the coalition are the two religious parties. Your audience, I would call that the ultra-religious parties, the very devout parties. One is UTJ, which is the Ashkenazi one, and Shas is the Sephardic and Mizrahi one. The third and final plank of the coalition are these extreme right parties that we just mentioned.
And there's also Noam, right?
Noam is part of this. So Noam is the religious Zionist party, Jewish Power, and Noam ran on a single list in the last election. And they were elected to parliament and they are the third biggest plank of the current coalition. If we add them all together, though, it's probably not very accurate at this point to say they're all on the same side anymore. There are, of course, tensions between them. But Noam is a single MK named Avi Maoz, whose main priority seems to be homophobia. But he is part of that block of MKs, which represents about 14 members of Knesset.
What role have these different factions and parties played in maybe the lead up to this? Because I feel like we've been spiraling towards escalation for a while now. And, you know, not just in Israel. You know, I hasten to mention that we have an August 2023 interview of Salal al-Ahori. And I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but he's one of the officials for Hamas who's on Lebanese TV saying, this is what we want. We want total war. And I think we're seeing that now, you know, this breaking down of the civilian combatant distinction and whatnot. So this has been building for a while. Who are the main parties in regards to the escalation happening?
Well, and I would add to that, by the way, there was a report in the Associated Press today with sources in Egyptian intelligence saying they warned Israel that something big was being planned in Gaza and that those warnings went largely unheeded. But the main protagonists right now are currently Israel and Hamas. I know there's a lot of talk about whether or not the Iranians authorized this operation. They certainly support Hamas, but I think that they're the stronger proxy, their stronger relationship is certainly with Hezbollah. I don't think that this was something that was ordered by Tehran, but certainly could have been coordinated or planned with them. And Hamas's drone capacities are most likely attributable in some way to either Iranian support or Iranian know-how. But another player involved in this, or another two that are very likely to get involved as we hopefully move toward a negotiated outcome or a ceasefire, will be Turkey and Qatar, which have the relationship with Hamas, have some semblance of a relationship with Hamas, and they will hopefully be the ones who can help lead to a de-escalation. But right now, it seems terribly unlikely that will happen anytime soon. It seems almost inevitable that there will be a ground invasion of Gaza sometime this week.
I guess where I was going, though, is in the lead up to all of this, has there been, both on the side of Hamas and on the side of these figures like Itamar Ben-Gvir, the rhetoric is getting much more extreme in the lead up to this? You know, we had the events in Huwara and whatnot. How does that play a role in the lead up to all of this?
It played a role in, as you said, kind of ratcheting up the rhetoric. But what needs to be mentioned at this point is that this was all focused on the West Bank. This was not rhetoric directed at Hamas. I think the current the Israeli policy towards Gaza has not changed much since the current government came in, despite having all of these extreme right parties. What has changed is, well, first of all, there's this entire issue that has divided Israeli society in quite strident and difficult terms, which is this battle over the judicial overhaul, which is, you know, at this point created an opportunity for any external enemy of Israel to strike at some point. I think that's That's without a doubt a factor here. So politically, Hamas was not playing a major role in what has happened, in what's been happening in Israel over the last year, and not even the ratcheting up of rhetoric regarding Palestinians, because it was largely focused on the West Bank and Jerusalem. As for Hamas itself, I agree that you probably would, if you go back through the archives of the last few months and through interviews, listen to the kind of fiery rhetoric you just mentioned that was on Lebanese television. I think the only thing that can then be said, perhaps in defense of Israeli intelligence, is that there would be nothing new in that regard. This has always been Hamas's line. The question is, was it their practice? And for the last... So the past few years, the Israeli view of Hamas has been that there isn't, that they were not looking for any sort of escalation, that this was, that their priority was to govern Gaza, to stay in control of Gaza. And in some ways, this was an Israeli interest as well, because Israel did not see itself as gaining anything from there being chaos in Gaza. So in the past, whenever rockets have flown out of Gaza, usually the priority has been, if it wasn't Hamas firing them, to respond in a very targeted way, usually against Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is another Iranian-backed militant group operating in the area, in a way that Hamas would not feel compelled to intervene. So the idea that Hamas would launch this kind of brutal attack or invasion, essentially, Israel was not part of the Israeli concept, as it would say in Hebrew, or conceptia, that they took into account. It was not something they thought was possible or was something Hamas was even considering.
I know you've been on social media and you've likely seen all the responses from the left, the far left, the center, the right, the crazy far right. I'm now seeing far right wingers in the US like Laura Loomer saying that, oh, there's going to be an attack any day now by Hamas, which has infiltrated the US. I'm seeing all kinds of really, I think, wild takes. Maybe you could give your view on the response we've seen in the media and elsewhere from both the left and right on the recent attack and then the Israeli response.
So I have to say some people have greatly disappointed me over the last couple of days. I don't expect the international left or people who identify very strongly with the Palestinian cause, as do I, to say that what happened was unprovoked. I don't think what happened was unprovoked. But when it comes to the clearly purposeful massacring of civilians, which has happened here without any doubt, I don't advise people to look for the gruesome videos that are circulating online, but they're as clear as day. This concert that was attacked in the Negev was very clearly not a military installation of any kind. These were civilians, and the fact that they were gunned down is unjustifiable. And I don't think it hurts us to say that, alongside the fact that the status quo of occupation, and frankly something that very resembles apartheid, can continue, because it can't continue. But we can't lose that very basic moral standard not to endorse something like this, or not to even appear to endorse something like this. And that's been somewhat shocking to me. As for how the right wing has reacted, I'm not surprised that the Republicans have tried to say that this war is now the fault of Joe Biden for having agreed to exchange hostages held by Iran in exchange for releasing frozen funds. It's entirely nonsense. These funds have not been released yet, and B, they are not simply being given to Iran, right? They're being put into an escrow account that can only be used to purchase certain things. So I'm not surprised that they've done this, that they've sunk this low, but I don't think it will gain any traction beyond their base. And to maybe touch back on the left for a second, is that I hope when this is all over, and hopefully without much more loss of life, there will be a serious reflection on how people reacted to something that should not have, you know, I barely have the words to describe some of what I saw on Twitter in particular.
I was going to say, one of the responses I've seen is that even the people at these festivals were settlers. So this issue of settler colonialism comes up, and I guess I just want you to comment on what your thoughts are on the arguments about settler colonialism in Israel.
So settler colonialism is a paradigm or a way of looking at a current situation or a historical situation. And many scholars have used it to have applied it to the Israeli case. And there are many reasons why it would fit such a case. But I think what you're concerned about and what you're asking is how this is being used today in political discourse. And I think these are two entirely different things. First, when we talk about settlers and settler colonialism, we have to think that this is not something that's taking place only in small corners of the world. The United States, Canada, Australia, Brazil, these are all settler colonial republics. The vast majority of citizens in the United States are settlers in the settler colonial paradigm. When we think of the problems and the destruction caused by settler colonialism, we also need to consider that in many respects, it's irreversible. And we have to think about how we are going to build a future where the injustices caused by settler colonialism are mitigated to the greatest extent possible. Most Israelis have nowhere really else to go. There are people with dual citizenship, but it's certainly not the majority of the population. One particularly stupid thing I saw on Twitter was this post of a fairly normal line at Ben Gurion Airport with the claim that Israelis were fleeing to their mother countries, which is bizarre. After several generations, settler colonialism is normalized, and we accept that in the U.S., we accept that in Brazil, we accept it in Canada, we accept it in Australia. We should think very seriously about our history and what we can do to, again, mitigate those initial crimes of settler colonialism. But this idea that it's going to be root and branch reversed is something unconscionable to me. And one striking feature of this discourse is the quoting of The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon. And I'll add that it's a very selective quoting of Fanon. Fanon did not actually believe that settlers should be uprooted and returned to Europe. In fact, if one reads to the end of The Wretched of the Earth, they will learn that he is imagining a completely new society in which these distinctions don't matter anymore. But even apart from the theoretical question, what's being said in these discussions, and I hope I'm being clear enough on this, is that it's not a way forward politically in any shape or form. I think it's a useful paradigm to look at history, to look at maybe how we got here.
But you're not saying that we have to throw out that as a paradigm. Yeah.
No. I think it's quite, like, there are real serious scholars who work with it. Rashid Khalidi has a book, his most recent book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, uses that paradigm. And it's certainly not something he believes. Arnon Dagani is another historian who uses it. Lorenzo Veracini, like, there are uses for this. I'm not saying that anyone who talks about Israeli settler colonialism is suggesting that all Israelis have to leave. But when it is deployed politically in this way, it is, in my view, quite destructive and counterproductive to the cause of Palestinian liberation.
So another thing we should mention is, I mean, I think when we're talking about settlers, it gets used in a number of different ways,
right,
in the context.
No, that's a good point. Yes. So we're not talking just about West Bank settlers, right?
Because that is like an ongoing process of basically, illegal settlements. They're kicking people off the land, right, taking homes. Yeah.
That's colonization, what's happening there. And I think settler colonialism, we're referring to something entirely different. This is not simply a country entering territory and colonizing it. This is often people being sent to settle and colonize. And the link between what we might think of as the mother country and the settler population is not the same as it is in a formal colonization context, right? There isn't one place that the settlers can return to. That's definitely, everyone understands that to be the context of the United States, that at this point, especially if someone's been here several generations, what is their mother country, right? They're mixes of different ethnic groups, of different settler groups that came here. At this point, 75 years after Israel was founded, it is a fact that there are Jews in Israel who are Israelis, and they don't have another country to go to. So it's simply, to again, as a historical usage, as a way to think about the conflict, I have no moral objection to using settler colonialism. I just think politically it is a road to nowhere.
But again, that's not to say that the settlements that are being made now should be accepted.
No. And I think in that case, we need to look at that as Israel, an existing country, and, you know, and sticking its hand into territory and trying to colonize it, to try to expand it and to expand itself. That is a very different question. I don't know whether, you know, if we're talking 200 years from now and these settlements have grown into something different, I don't know what the analysis then would be of what to do, morally speaking. I presume at that point there would, you know, not to enter that world, but I think where we stand right now, yes, you're right, that when I say that settler colonialism needs to be acknowledged or accepted, I'm not referring to the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
So since we've probably pissed off at least some leftists that are listening to this, let's also piss off some centrists and liberals, because, you know, it's funny, everyone is using this both sidesism line now. I see it everywhere, right, left, center. The thing is, you said that this is not unprovoked. And I know there will be centrists and liberals listening to this to say, what do you mean by that? Why are you both sides in this? So why are you saying that it's unprovoked? Because
it's not
agree
unprovoked.
With you. What I meant, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it really depends on how one defines provocation. If there has to be a very proximate and proportionate trigger, then sure, it wasn't provoked in that sense. But Gaza has been under blockade since 2007. You know, millions of Palestinians are suffering. There is a state of hopelessness throughout the Palestinian territories. I can't be surprised that this happened. I'm horrified that it's happened, but I can't in good conscience say it was unprovoked, because Israeli policy over the last, again, 10 or 15 years has been that the Palestinians are not in need of any solution, that the status quo can continue for as long as it needs to. Israel can continue to expand settlements and there will be no consequences to this. I'm sorry, I don't know what else to say. I don't think what Hamas did is right. It's, in fact, they've committed terrible war crimes over the last 2 days. It's abominable. I don't blame the fact, I understand why there will be some sort of military response, even though I am completely opposed to the idea that there needs to be a large-scale invasion or the blood-curdling rhetoric that came out from Defense Minister Gallant today about not letting food, supplies, or electricity into Gaza. These are prima facie violations of the Geneva Convention. So I just don't understand how people can be surprised given the way Israel has treated the Palestinians over the last 56 years, for one, but particularly how the Palestinians have been ignored, have been talked down to, have been sidelined and isolated. There's
Can you speak about that in a little bit more detail if listeners are unfamiliar?
Yeah. So the last major negotiation over a two-state solution happened in 2014, and it wasn't particularly serious. I don't think either Netanyahu or Abbas, or frankly, even Secretary of State John Kerry, really put in or really believed that that outcome was going to happen from those talks. So in fact, we could go back to 2007 in Annapolis as being the last time a two-state solution was seriously pondered by world powers. And since then, and this is especially true in Gaza, things have generally become worse and worse for Palestinians. And you know, this is a population, I don't have the statistics in front of me, that is quite young. This is all they've ever known. They don't know about the First Intifada or the Oslo Accords, or, you know, many, many Palestinians today weren't even alive for the Second Intifada. So they were born in misery. They've been growing up in further misery and don't see any way out. I'm horrified, but I can't say I'm surprised.
Where do you think, I mean, it's hard even talking about all of this. This is the third interview I've done on it today, and it's, you know, it gets to me. So where do you think things have to go from here? I mean, what's your hope, and then what do you think the reality is?
My hope would be that the United States would be a responsible international actor and seek a ceasefire in the coming days. While it's unrealistic that Israel will settle for that anytime soon, I think that should be the message from Washington, and not to even inadvertently endorse an escalation whose end is unpredictable and can last quite a long time. A new conflict, a new hot conflict. What's likely to happen, unfortunately, is what appears to be, based on all the reports I'm seeing now, a large-scale Israeli invasion with no clear objective besides to more or less defeat Hamas to take out their operational abilities. But of course, as we talked about earlier, I don't think the Israeli priority of not fully toppling Hamas has gone away. I don't think Netanyahu wants to be holding that bag at the end of this. And the Palestinian Authority is most likely unwilling to hold that bag. And so even if the response to what is happening, and so far the airstrikes that Israel is carrying out are quite extreme, even compared to 2014's Operation Protective Edge, but if it becomes even more harsh, the current response, I think there will still be thought given as to not fully dismantle or dislodge Hamas from power, because Israel currently has no alternative in Gaza.
With regards to the response thus far, I know we've talked about the shocking nature of the Hamas attack. Are you also shocked by anything with regards to the retaliation that's taking place? I mean, I can't tell what's happening right now in some ways, because I'm seeing conflicting reports, but I'm hearing the Rafah crossing has been hit, which would have been the way out to Egypt from Gaza. Egypt.
The reports that I'm seeing from Gaza, and again, these are largely unconfirmed social media postings, is that this is worse than it has ever been in at least the concentrated period of time that we're talking about. Hospitals appear to be overwhelmed, and much of the population is terrified. Nothing has really surprised me about the Israeli response so far. I think it was largely predictable, and I can't believe that Hamas would not have baked that into their calculations before launching this strike. Though, of course, there's the question of whether they thought they would be so successful, quote unquote. This could have just as easily ended in a massacre of Hamas militants in the Gaza buffer zone. Hamas doesn't have intelligence as to what Israel has in terms of capability in that area. So I don't The response is going to be very harsh. I wonder whether Hamas anticipated it, whether they anticipated their own, again, successes over the last couple of days. But I'm not surprised by the Israeli response. I would be surprised if the objective becomes to actually topple the Hamas regime, because that seems to be a path to a quagmire that most Israelis, even those promoting a fairly hawkish position today, realize that that Israel
can't
afford.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So in 2005, Israel disengaged from Gaza, withdrew its ground forces and its settlers. And the reason it did this was because it wasn't a tolerable situation for Israel anymore. It was facing, you know, daily attacks from Gaza. It was known to be trouble in the Israeli security establishment. It was not something they wanted to invest any resources it had felt, and I think quite rightly, that they would be more secure pulling out rather than having to constantly pacify an occupied population in Gaza. And so I don't think, you know, Israel wants to return to being in charge of the daily, day-to-day activities of Gaza. I don't think they can count on the Palestinian Authority to assume that role either. And so regardless of how harsh this response is, I don't anticipate Hamas will be dislodged from power in Gaza, though we're in unprecedented waters, of course, so I could be very wrong about that. But I don't see the underlying calculation on Israel's part changing as of yet.
Yeah, and when we say harsh, we should say too, I mean, this is going to incur a lot of casualties of Gazan civilians.
Yeah,
you know,
and it already
it's
has.
It's just very tragic, yeah. What do you think this means for Israel? Because, I mean, I don't know where this is going to go, because on one hand, this could harden anti-Palestinian sentiments in the public sphere. But at the same time, this could be very bad for Netanyahu's government. I mean, you have Lapid coming out and saying, you know, you got to ditch these far right wingers. We need an emergency government. Could this end up being very bad for Netanyahu?
I think it almost certainly will. I don't think he has a narrative to explain what happened. For many years, he's been Mr. Security. That's been his calling card.
I was
going to
say, there's not that I agree with these, but there's already conspiracy theories in Israel treating this, you know, similar to the 9/11 conspiracies we have. That's already popping up in certain areas of Israeli society.
Yeah, and what happened now is that I think has been completely discredited. I don't think he can ever come out and say that Israel will be safest under his leadership after what has happened, what has transpired over the last 2 days. He can say it. I don't think many more people will believe it anymore. As far as Israeli-Palestinian relations go and how that affects domestic politics in Israel, in the short term, it's no doubt that anti-Palestinian sentiment is going to increase. I would be particularly worried about relations between Israeli Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel within the Green Line, particularly in the so-called mixed cities, places like Lod, Rabla, Akko, and Jaffa, right? So this isn't, and Haifa as well. And there's a great potential for that kind of intercommunal violence, which we saw in May of 2021 when the war that was happening at that point was much, much less serious than what we're seeing today, though, of course, it was quite serious at the time. In the long term, or the medium to long term, I hope that the change in calculation with regard to the Palestinians from that passivity that we were talking about before, that nothing needs to be done, that the status quo can go on forever, is channeled into support for a long-term political solution to the conflict, which is the only sustainable and peaceful solution. I, you know, clearly no one sees that on the horizon now, but the, of course, the Yom Kippur War, as David Myers reminds us in a Los Angeles Times op-ed that he published yesterday, was the impetus for the Israel-Egypt reconciliation and peace agreement, was this wake-up call that this can't go on forever, that you can't hold on to these territories forever.
The occupation has to end.
Right. I'm not hopeful that this will be the lesson learned, but I think there is a possibility of that. And I think that's really what the left should be driving home, that this is evidence that the policy of occupation, of continuing that, of the status quo, of settlement expansion, that the belief that the Palestinians can be pacified forever is unsustainable. And if this continues to happen, we're only setting the clock for the next for the next horrifying attack.
Right, the next powder keg, you know. So, you know, another thing I wanted to get into, I just wanted to go back to this quickly. Assuming that this could be one of the things that really truly takes down Netanyahu, assuming that's a possibility, who would fill that vacuum?
So right now, the if we look at the polls, the number one competitor to Netanyahu would be Benny Gantz, former defense minister and IDF chief of staff, who's been active politically since 2019. The party that he leads is nominally centrist, though I think it's probably more accurate to say it's center-right. It includes people who are both in the past have supported a two-state solution, as well as people who have been very implacably opposed to two-states and have supported the settlements, including someone like Gideon Saar, who for many years was a senior Likud minister. But then again, you know, previously there were Israeli elected officials and leaders who had been opposed to territorial concessions, but when they were in power, agreed to them, Ariel Sharon being probably the most obvious example, and he oversaw the Gaza disengagement. So I don't know if I would read into that, you know, read into an ideology of a party or even an individual and say that this will flow naturally from their seat in government. Though, of course, we know that the far right is unlikely to ever support anything peaceful or humane. After Benny Gantz's party, there's Yesh Atid, which is Yair Lapid, and I think that they've taken really the mantle of the centrist liberal Israeli position that emerged out of the decimation of the Labor Party following the Second Intifada. You had a party called Kadima, which was founded by Ariel Sharon, but also included many former Labor Party members, and that was the start really of this large centrist party that Israel had, which it hadn't had before. And so Lapid, I think, still will be the head of that. But it's hard to predict where Israeli politics goes from here. Only last week, the number one issue facing Israel was the judicial overhaul that this current government is pushing through. And of course, that touched on a whole bunch of other fault lines that matter for Israeli politics. There are ethnic fault lines between Ashkenazim and Mizrahim, as well as Palestinian citizens of Israel. There's the separation or lack of it between religion and state, which is another issue that Yair Lapid has run on before and has drawn a lot of support for. And right now, in the current moment, it's hard to see because these issues are currently being suppressed. There's no one talking about this now, obviously. It's a situation of total chaos and war. So politically, I would presume that who would step in to fill that gap would be one of the current opposition leaders, but it's always possible that someone else steps in and gains a certain amount of political support, because right now we've really only known Netanyahu and anti-Netanyahu for the last 10 years or even longer by now. So it would be a very big shock to the system not to see him be a viable choice for prime minister. But that's where it seems to be going right now.
Where do you think and I know this is speculative, but where do you think the farthest right elements that we mentioned are going to land when it comes to the fallout from all of this? So the Ben-Gvirs, the Smotriches.
Yeah, it depends what happens now. If there is a national unity government in which the far-right parties are either kicked out or sidelined, they will almost certainly be demanding greater reprisals, a more harsh response. They will try to take advantage politically from that situation. If they are in government and have to own whatever decisions are made, I think they perhaps are likely to suffer just as much as Netanyahu, though maybe not just as much because they do have a certain hardened base that will always vote for the furthest right. But again, if the far right is in government and there is a military response that is deemed insufficient by far right members of society, I would expect another far right party to come and challenge them for the hegemony of the far right voting bloc in Israel. So that it really, again, will depend on the future of the Israeli cabinet in the coming days.
Just a few more things. Since we were talking about the Israeli far right, are there any parallels to be drawn between the Israeli far right and the American far right, not just in ideology, but I mean in terms of their record of governing? So it seems like Israel has had a lot of chaos since we've seen the Netanyahu coalition with these different far right parties in power, just as we saw a lot of chaos during the Trump administration. Are there parallels between Israeli politics and American politics in your view?
Not to make the broader comparison, but if we're talking about the far right, then there's certainly a connection or an affinity. And the Israeli far right is integrated in what we might call the global far right. I think that they're seen as fellow travelers by other far right parties, even parties that have pasts of horrific anti-Semitism and even neo-Nazism. So they are on that same side of the spectrum, very extreme, very racist, very xenophobic. Sometimes the rhetoric might, you know, you might hear echoes of the same thing, you know, you will not replace us. And these are, you know, commonalities of the far right throughout the Western world. So it's not a surprise that there would be parallels. The political system, however, in Israel is, of course, very different.
Right, right.
There isn't a bipolar system, right, that we have in the United States, where now that the far right has essentially captured the Republican Party, we have a one party that is a center left party, I guess, in the best of times, and a far right party. And that isn't the spectrum that's currently exists in Israel, even though the Likud party is much, much further to the right than it was, you know, even 5 years ago. The far, far right, the Ben-Gvir, the Smotrich, are still, as a proportion of their power in government, not quite what we would think of, you know, and the equivalent of the Republican Party or the Trump administration in them being in control of the entire executive apparatus. But they have governed incompetently. That is absolutely true. Even I would think even some of Ben-Gvir's own supporters realize that as being the head of the National Security Ministry, or since assuming the leadership of the National Security Ministry, the Israeli police have not functioned very well. Crime, violent crime, is up significantly. In particularly where Palestinian citizens of Israel live, and Ben-Gvir has been caught flat-footed. He doesn't know
That's
what to do.
He because not didn't a... he didn't he declare total war on crime in Israel, in Israeli society?
Yeah, and he has been a total failure in that regard. The murder rate, again, I'm only thinking of Palestinian citizens of Israel right now, has more than doubled compared to last year, and it was already elevated in the past years. There's been a terrible crime wave, most likely driven by organized crime and other gang-related incidents, and the Israeli police have not responded to it adequately at all. And part of this is certainly attributable to the fact that when Ben-Gvir entered office, there were certain relationships that the police had with Arab communities in Israel that were suddenly ruptured. And this lack of cooperation, this lack of trust, and the communication from the very top that Palestinians don't matter has trickled down. The idea that Ben-Gvir has provided any sort of security to Israelis living in Israel, not even during times of war, is bizarre. It's shattered by the reality of his governance.
So I've been speaking on and off to a lot of my Palestinian friends and Palestinian American friends in the past few days, and it's hard not to acknowledge their frustration when it comes to media coverage and also the response of especially Democrats to these events, because I do think there is a double standard and a sort of, I would say, anti-Arab racism at work when it's as if this is all being viewed in a vacuum. You know, as horrible as the Hamas attack was, I don't think we can forget, you know, about Huwara and the burning down of, you know, cars, houses in Huwara, the killing of Shireen Abu Akla. Do you think that Palestinian voices have a point when they say that they feel that there is a double standard in how we talk about all of this?
They absolutely have a point. And that gets, I think, back to the question of unprovoked and provoked, right? Where if we think of this as something that has happened to interrupt a period of calm or quiet, then of course we can see how one might think that this was unprovoked. But if we see this as an escalation in a continuous situation of violence inflicted on Palestinians, then we have to look at it very differently. And I think the American press, and this might not just be limited to how it covers the Middle East, but how it covers international affairs more generally, tends to look at things as discrete events, that this is something that has broken out now and we're going to cover it that way. I will say that I agree that your Palestinian friends, as well as mine, are right to be frustrated with that. I think we should also acknowledge that things have improved over the last 20 or 30 years. I think if this war had broken out in 1990, I don't think we would have as many Palestinian voices as I've seen, say, on CNN or MSNBC over the last couple of days.
Did you happen to see the Fareed Zakaria interview with
Mostafa Barghouti?
Yeah. I don't know if you wanted to mention that briefly, but...
Yeah, I and some of these figures have in the past appeared in the Western media, but I think that there is, even if it isn't enough, and even if certain blind spots and prejudices are still present, I don't think we can say nothing has changed over the last, you know, couple of decades and how this conflict is covered. I think the members of the press, particularly younger people who now maybe occupy certain positions, either as booking producers or script writers, are more conscious of the Palestinian perspective than their predecessors were. Not to, you know, some of their predecessors were very good people who did good work even on this issue, but I think generally as a claim, the current crop of people working in the mainstream media, it's not the same as it once was. I think that we can acknowledge that, alongside saying that yes, there are still too many instances where the Israeli perspective is presented as the normative one, and that there's no need to look at how Palestinians have reacted to this, or to treat their voices as mainly something to be examined from a point of view of looking down upon it or condescension. As for the interview you mentioned with Mostafa Barghouti, which I would recommend everyone watch, I thought it was very good that CNN did that. It was comparatively lengthy for a cable news segment, but he was able to present, I think, the Palestinian position in a very cogent manner. Of course, he's not a member of Fatah or Hamas, so perhaps one could say that his view is more in line with those who are not, you know, politically active every day. While he is a politician, I don't think he's had any role in the Palestinian Authority in a very, very long time. He's more or less an opposition figure, even a marginal one. But I still think that what he said was quite important, even if I disagreed with one thing that he said, which was that Hamas was mainly targeting military installations, which I think is clearly not true. But in the circumstances that he's in, I'm not going to condemn him for not potentially putting himself in danger. I can't believe that he believes that Hamas has been targeting only military infrastructure.
You mentioned Iran earlier. I've had a lot of dissenting opinions on this show about Iran as it regards this. Most people I know are saying they want more evidence that Iran is more directly involved in this. And everyone I know is sort of pushing back on the Republican line that, you know, the Democrats gave this money to the Iranians and the Iranians gave it to Hamas. So maybe you could just again reiterate your stance on the Iran question.
Sure. There's right now no evidence that this was either coordinated or ordered by the Iranian regime. It may very well have been, but we cannot say that at this point based on what we know. If we want to speculate responsibly, I think it's highly unlikely that Iran had no idea that something like this would happen. I find that to be a little bit unrealistic, just given the fact that they have their own militia or the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is much closer to Iran and actually does have certain operational connections to Iran, which I don't think Hamas currently has, would have known that this was happening too. So it seems unlikely that Iran was in the dark, but we don't have any evidence that there was coordination or that this was planned between Hamas and Iran together. There is, of course, the possibility that Iran gets progressively more involved if this conflict spreads out of control. Of course, we know about their relationship with Hezbollah, and if the war were to expand into a new front at that point, if Hezbollah were to be involved, we could probably say that an Iranian proxy has joined the conflict. But I don't think we can characterize Hamas in that way. I would just encourage people to look at the recent history of Hamas's relationship with Iran, particularly what happened in the war in Syria, where Hamas left Damascus because they had opposed the Assad regime shortly after the civil war started. And that created a rupture between Hamas and Iran. Now, they have reconciled since then, but I don't think it is currently accurate to say that Hamas is simply an Iranian proxy. It's simplistic, it's manipulative, and it seems to me to be pure political rhetoric that only matters in the United States. In Israel right now, this is not being presented as an Iranian attack. It's being presented as a Hamas attack. And so what this is being driven by, unfortunately, appear to be American political calculations.
Is there anything, since I mentioned I have Palestinian-American listeners, is there anything you want to say to them right now?
I don't know. I'm speaking from the perspective of an American Jew who, while is strongly opposed to the Israeli occupation and to the reality of apartheid that's been created there, I can't endorse the most extreme positions that have come out of the Palestinian diaspora over the last couple of days. I know that this probably doesn't matter to many of them, and I can't possibly tell them in this moment that it should matter. But I hope that the Palestinian diaspora and the pro-Palestinian movement in general can find a way to express, and it's hard to find the words here, but to find a way to express their political power and their political influence and their, you know, however small it may be now, to first to fight on the fundamental injustices that are currently taking place and are being committed by Israel. I don't think we And again, this is again very inarticulate, but for instance, the protests that were taking place in Times Square and where I am in New York over the weekend, there were certain chants, there were certain signs that seemed to be tailored to provoke a response out of American Jews. And I don't see a value in that. I'm kind of at a loss for words at this. I just hope that in, because, you know, we're in the United States, there are Palestinian Americans. There's, of course, the broader Arab American community, and there's an American Jewish community. And I don't want this to spiral into a conflict between people who live here. And I don't think it has to, and I don't think it should. Even where I live in Brooklyn, there is a mix of there are Palestinians here, and there are, you know, obviously a very large Jewish community, and I worry that some of this could spill over into street fighting that again has no political objective beyond beating or what we might see as a representative of the other side. And I hope that in these protests, even if views are expressed that I find alarming or disagreeable or even abhorrent, that it doesn't lead to street violence that has no, and I repeat, no utility whatsoever in the region to be fighting on the streets of New York, Detroit, or Los Angeles. It doesn't contribute anything beyond causing immediate pain to people.
Do you worry that that could happen with, I guess, maybe far-right elements of the American Jewish community getting into fights or having fights with Palestinians? Or because I could see that happening on both sides.
No, yes, that's what I'm worried about. I don't think the median protester on either side of the camp is there to fight physically. I think most are not going to engage in that, but you have these fringe groups that will escalate situations like these. And of course, at the end of the day, that becomes the story and not, you know, peaceful demonstrations one way or the other. And I am worried about that. I don't think the Jewish far right is as organized as it used to be, but
it's a different world than when Kahana was around, right?
Right, right. There's effectively no JDL anymore. So what we have are these smaller, you know, largely informal groups that sometimes connect on social media. But they're very like, you know, if a couple of hundred people show up on either side, you know, they're likely to make up a certain percentage on each side. And I hope that those leading these protests and counter protests tailor their message in a way that cannot be easily exploited by these elements as a call to arms of some sorts. But I realize that this message is likely, just given the emotions of the moment and the, frankly, the source from which it's coming, it is unlikely to be taken seriously and more
likely
to be dismissed.
There's a lot of trauma at work right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we close out, I have to ask, is there any way you could see us moving towards, you know, an immediate ceasefire, a de-escalation? Who would be involved in that? I know, I think Turkey has talked about wanting to mediate, maybe Qatar. Could you speak to that?
Until the United States pursues a ceasefire as its objective, it is highly unlikely to materialize. Because the United States at this moment is really the only party that can pull Israel back from the brink. On the side of Hamas, we're talking again about Turkey and Qatar. Those are the two international interlocutors with a ongoing relationship with Hamas, besides Iran, which isn't going to be a factor in any diplomatic negotiation around ending the current round of fighting. And so I imagine that will be the route that's pursued when Israel is ready to pursue it. And that seems to be Biden's position as of now, that we're going to support the Israeli retaliation, that we fully stand with Israel, and that we're not at this point pushing for a ceasefire, which I think is deeply unfortunate. I think it will result in many unnecessary lives being unnecessarily lost, just to lead to the same exact outcome that we could be pushing for now.
Why do you think the U.S. is pursuing this line of doing it this way?
I think that's just the position of the current American foreign policy establishment, is that if Israel is attacked, we need to support it. Certainly there will be disagreement of how long that should last and to what extent we should be supporting them. But I'm not surprised that this is the Biden administration's position, as much as I think that it's short-sighted and that it would be better to start at least talking about a ceasefire now, even if Israel isn't ready to talk about it yet, that this should still be the message coming out from the United States. But you know, the U.S.-Israel relationship today, it's just not at that point where we would be willing to do that in the face of such an attack on Israel.
Last thing here. I know we mentioned issues with maybe pro-Hamas sentiment from some people, but on the opposite end of that, something I've also seen that very much perturbs me are sort of what I would call, you know, centrist sort of liberal voices that are saying things like the Palestinian cause is dead. Palestinians have no goodwill now because of this, you know, equating all Palestinians with Hamas. And to be honest, I have a lot of contempt for those people. I think it's pretty offensive to say, you know, the Palestinian cause is dead. I mean, I think Palestinians have been around a lot longer than a lot of people saying this. So could you just comment on that kind of response that we're seeing from some corners right now?
It's, well, when it comes from seemingly intelligent people, I think I tend to assume that it's an emotional response because it's not realistic. I think Palestinians, as you said, have been around for longer than they have. There are millions of them within territory Israel controls. The Palestinian cause will not be dead as long as Palestinians are around. And to think otherwise is to subscribe to the delusion that, frankly, I think has brought us here to this point, that Palestinian rights can be ignored, that Palestinian objectives don't need to be addressed, that Palestinian self-determination doesn't matter, and that the status quo can continue or be worse and not have certain consequences.
And so, you would say that applies with how the U.S. treats this issue as well as within Israel itself.
Right. The U.S., at least under the Biden administration, has not prioritized this issue. In fact, it has deprioritized this issue. Up until recently, the main U.S. Priority with regard to Israel was to shepherd through this visa waiver program, which is scarcely believable now that this is what the priority for U.S. policy was in Israel. But that was the main project of our former ambassador, Tom Nides. And I think that this is, you know, Biden deserves a great deal of criticism as well for what's happened. I think we didn't have our eye on the ball either. And to believe that this is something that could stay quiet for good was a delusion that was accepted in Washington just as much as it was accepted in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And it was wrong. And if anyone now says the Palestinian cause is dead, they're just preparing themselves for the next time they're going to be tragically wrong and many people will die.
Also, just that other issue of, I guess, the conflation, you know, conflating all Palestinians to Hamas.
Yeah. And if I can make one comment about that, there's also a claim that's frequently made. It was made in an article by Tariq Ali in the New Left Review over the weekend, that the Hamas government in Gaza is elected. And this is basically false. I think the election that's often referred to in this statement is the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections, which Hamas did indeed win. But again, those were the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections. They were not the Gaza dictatorship elections. And the reason why Hamas came to power in Gaza was because they had won those elections, and the Fatah movement led by Mahmoud Abbas turned on them and tried to more or less physically pacify Hamas. And Hamas seized control of Gaza and has governed since 2007 as basically a dictatorship. And the notion that an election that took place over 17 years ago that had nothing to do with governing Gaza in particular is a source of democratic legitimacy for Hamas, I think is a kind of logic no one would accept for any other situation as a source of democratic legitimacy.
I think we've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything you just want to say in closing here that I may have missed? It's been a long day for me. I know it's been a long day for you, but any parting words?
I guess the first is to just forgive at any point if I sounded inarticulate or muddled. It's just the state of my mind right now. And the last thing I will add reiterate is that we all know how this is likely to end, and it's likely to end in some sort of agreement reached between Israel and Hamas on a new status quo. And the only question is how many more innocent people, and maybe some not innocent people, have to die before it reaches that point, before it reaches a conclusion that, to me, looking at the current state of things, seems inevitable, given that Israel is not looking to take control of Gaza. And I hope the Biden administration is thinking beyond the current Israeli response and has a plan to slowly get Israel to climb down from the tree it has somewhat understandably climbed up over the last 2 days, given the horror that it's experienced.
Well, I want to thank you again, Abe Silberstein, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with you and your work?
So I, for now, am back on Twitter. So that's ABESILBE. You can follow me there. I have a Substack, although it's seldom updated, and I usually use it to just point to work that I've published elsewhere. And now I'm also on Blue Sky, which is one of the couple of alternatives to Twitter that have emerged since Elon Musk purchased the site last year. And it's the same at that I am on Twitter, ABESILBE.
Thank you again, Abe Silberstein.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Abe Silberstein. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. My heart goes out to all those suffering in Israel and in Gaza. This has been a very hard few days for me. I have contacts in both areas, and this whole thing is just devastating. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.